My name is Bob Dell. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm sober today only through the grace and power of God and the program, the people, and the principles, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Remy for inviting me down here to share with you. I got to tell you guys how much I appreciate the treatment we've gotten since we've been here with what an incredible hotel and the fruit basket, and just the people were so warm and friendly. And those of us that do this a lot and start to feel like sometimes like we're living out of a suitcase, where it's not always that way. I want to tell you how much I appreciate the way we've been treated here this weekend. We've really been made to feel like we belong here. Now John screwed me up. I got to think through my whole talk and remember to. I'd like to welcome anybody that's new. I'm real glad you're here. I think, and I believe from my experience and what I've learned of alcoholism, that I was born with alcoholism. And I believe that I was like before I ever took a drink, I was I was like a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for alcohol. And I believe that because I was, the book says we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows, and there was always something that wasn't quite right about me. I didn't seem to fit well, and I don't know why that is. And I didn't come from an alcoholic home. I came from a home where I was loved and appreciated. I was never abused. I was never even hit. My folks were always on my side. They went to great lengths to give me good education and a good home and anything I needed. I always knew intellectually that I was loved, but there was something about me that I couldn't feel it. My sister, who doesn't have the spiritual malady of alcoholism, could feel the love. I couldn't feel it. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, says that selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our troubles, and I think even as a little kid, I was so introspective and self-focused and self-involved. I look back over my childhood, and really the only thing I can remember is me. I remember all about me. I can tell you everything that happened to me. I can't tell you too much about my folks or my sister unless it had to do with me. It had to do with me, I remember. I kept score. I knew everything had to do with me. And my mom used to tell me as a little kid, Rob, you're full of yourself. And I didn't know what that meant until I got into AA. It was, oh, yeah. And we used to go everywhere as a family. And one Sunday afternoon, I went with my mom and my dad to this farmer's market. And we're going in there because my dad wants to buy this horseradish that he's heard about that's won these awards. It's supposed to be hotter and spicier than any other horseradish. My dad loves stuff like that. And we're going into this farmer's market for him to get that stuff. And I'm listening to him brag to my mom about this horseradish. And he gets some of it, and we're going out to the car, and I've been hearing the commercial. So I said, Papa, can I have some? Now, I'm only like 3 or 4 years old, and he said to me, he says, oh, Rob, you can't have any. It's too powerful. It's only for adults. You can't have any. Well, I'm the kind of kid that I may not even really want something until you tell me I can't have it. And then once you tell me I can't have it, I got to have it. To this day, I can't make it past the do not touch wet paint sign without going like that. That's my nature. So my dad said I couldn't have it, so now I can't get it out of my mind, right? I'm still that way. I don't swear from the podium. I don't do it. I've never done it. But if you tell me don't do it before I got to talk, then it goes through my head for the whole time. I'm that kind of guy. And I waited till my folks weren't around. I snuck in that kitchen, opened that refrigerator, got out that jar of horseradish, got a big spoon, sat there on the floor of the kitchen, opened that jar of horseradish, stuck the spoon in there, put it in my mouth. I think I saw God. I'm not sure. Snots poured out of my nose and tears were running down my eyes. I spit horseradish over that kitchen. Sick, 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 sick. I gotta tell you, that was 40 some years ago. I have not once sat with a jar of horseradish and a big spoon. Didn't have to get no sponsor, go to no meetings, work no steps, none of them. But I also gotta tell you, Square Business, that if that horseradish would have done for me what alcohol did for me, I'd have spent the rest of my life making myself sick with that stuff every chance I can get. Because I was born with a spiritual malady called alcoholism. I was born with a vacancy. I was born with a hole inside of me. And nobody around me had that hole. Nobody in my family. I was the only one. And because I've wondered something over the years. I've thought about it. I've listened to a lot of Fifth Steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've heard alcoholics who felt like I felt, acted like I acted, and they came from homes where they were beaten and abused and tortured as children. And I've run into Alcoholics Anonymous that came from alcoholics who came from Ozzie and Harriet type homes, and they felt the same way that I felt, because I came from one of those kind of homes. So, and I thought to myself, well, what is it? If it has nothing to do with where you came from, what is it? How come I'm an alcoholic and my sister's not an alcoholic? How come people who come from good homes sometimes are and sometimes aren't? People come from bad homes sometimes are and sometimes aren't. And one of the favorite pastimes that people, at least in my area, we go out to coffee, and these are some of the philosophical questions we ponder into the early hours of the morning. And a couple years ago, I went to a movie with a bunch of people in AA, and the movie was called Just Cause. And it's a movie with Sean Connery, and it's about this serial killer. And there's a scene in the movie, and I'm watching this movie, and Sean Connery goes into this prison to interview this wacko serial killer. This guy is so crazy, he got handcuffed to the table. He's nuts. And Sean Connery starts to talk to him, and the guy starts ranting and raving. He says, yeah, they've had doctors in here examining me, trying to figure out why I do the things I do. They've had psychiatrists in here examining me, trying to figure out what it was in my childhood that made me this way. And he starts this maniacal laugh, and he says, what they'll never understand is that some people were just born with a hunger. When he said that, I turned to the other people in the movie, and I just thought, yeah, some people are just born with a hunger. And I was born with a hunger. And I was born with a vacancy. And I was born restless, irritable, and discontent. It was had nothing to do. My sister doesn't like that. But there was something about me. And when I first took my first drink of alcohol when I was 12 years old, it made me feel so good that the way I felt from that moment on without it was never really okay again. And I started to live for the effect that I found in drinking. When you're 12 years old, you can't drink every day, but I drank every chance I could get. And my alcoholism was a disease of diminishing returns. When I first started drinking when I was 12 years old, it was magic. All of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I felt like I fit. I felt like I could come out and play. I didn't have to pretend like I was cool anymore. I was. I was a part of. I got in a little bit of trouble. A lot of fun, a little bit of trouble. And as the years went on, the trouble increased and the fun and the effect diminished until by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978, I'm desperately trying to wring some kind of fun out of the bottle and I can't. There's nothing left. And my life was destroyed. There's nothing left of any value inside me or outside me. And in that journey from the time I was 12 years old to the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978, I created a lot of damage in my life and I hurt a lot of people. And I did a lot of things that I was ashamed of. Because I'm the alcoholic that it talks about in the Big Book. Dr. Silkworth says that guys like me, we have a physical allergy to alcohol, but unlike other allergies, like if you're allergic to strawberries and you eat strawberries, you break out in hives. When I drink alcohol, I don't break out in hives. I break out in what Silkworth calls a phenomenon of craving. Now, I remember I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1971 as a young kid in an institution. And I would hear people talk about this phenomenon of craving. And I don't get it. I don't have a phenomenon of craving. I mean, I've seen The Lost Weekend and Days of Wine and Roses. I don't drink and claw the walls to get another drink. But the interesting thing about a craving is you don't realize you have it until it's interrupted. Everybody in this room right now is in the grip of a craving that you're not aware of, the craving to breathe air. But if somebody snuck up behind you with a plastic bag and put it over your head, you'd instantly become aware that you have this craving to breathe air. And my alcoholism was a lot like that. I didn't understand that. I couldn't see that I had the craving because I went to great lengths to protect myself from situations where my drinking was interrupted. If I could only have two, I would pass. And I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the years that I'm in and out, and I'm listening to a woman share her experience, and all of a sudden I remembered something that had happened to me when I was about 18 years old. Now, you got to understand, when I was 18 years old, in my mind, there's no way I'm an alcoholic. When I was 18 years old, I was going through my long-haired, better-living-through-chemistry phase of my alcoholism, right? But alcoholism doesn't care what war you're protesting or how long your hair is. I mean, it does. If you have alcoholism, you have alcoholism, even if you don't believe it. And I'm at 18, I'm dating a gal, and she invites me over to her parents' house for dinner. She wanted me to meet her family. So, you know, I hate stuff like that, but I go because I'm trying to be a good guy, and I go, and we're sitting at this dinner table with her and I and her mom and her dad, and there's four of us, and they bring out this bottle of wine. Now, it's not a big bottle of wine. It's just a little bottle of wine. And they pour us all a glass of wine, and I drink quickly. Evaporation must be some childhood issue with me or something. I don't know what the deal is, but I drink quickly. And because I drink quickly, I finish two glasses out of that bottle of wine. They're still sipping on their first glass, and the bottle's dead. And I'm sitting there, I don't know, I'm 18 years old, I don't know anything about alcoholism, I don't know anything about allergy, phenomenon of craving. I'm sitting there, I got two glasses of wine in me, and I'm getting squirrely. And I wanted another. I finally said to him, boy, that was good wine, do you have any more? And they said no, and they went back to talking, and I'm sitting there. Now, I'm going to be stuck there for the rest of the evening. And I finally, after, I'm going nuts, I finally, after a couple minutes, I said, sure like beer. They said, well, that's nice, Bob, we don't have any beer. And they went back to talking about Vietnam and sports and all this other stuff. And I'm sitting there, I got two glasses of wine in me, and I'm losing my mind. You know how you talk to yourself in your head? It's getting panicky in there, and just crazy stuff is coming out. And I'm sitting there, I don't know what to do. I excuse myself, I go to the bathroom, I lock the door. Like a crazed maniac, I go through the cabinets in there, found a bottle of cough medicine, 35% alcohol with codeine and terpenhydrate, sat down on the edge of the bathtub, chugged that bottle of cough medicine, instantly achieved what it talks about in our 12 concepts, singleness of purpose. All of a sudden, all the voices in my head got real focused. I could think straight. I was able to sit there and come up with a story, went back out to the dinner table, sat down, explained to them about this thing I forgot about that I had to take care of, and they were real nice about it. I went out, got in my car, they were so sorry to see me go, I have to come back, yes, got in my car, drove down the street 20, 25 miles an hour, turned the corner, got out of sight, drove 80, 70, 90 miles an hour like a maniac to get to a friend's house who had a bar in the basement because I had two glasses of wine. And those two glasses of wine did something to me inside that it didn't do to any of those other people. If any of those other people would have been alcoholics, we'd have all been in that goddamn bathroom looking through those cabinets. But something happens to me when I drink that doesn't happen to them. And I got to Alcoholics Anonymous the last time in 1978. And I finally was bludgeoned by my experience of trying to control my drinking into an acceptance that I was that type of person. Now, I couldn't have put it into words. I couldn't have told you a phenomenon of craving. I couldn't have said any of that stuff. But I knew that I was one of those people that when I take a drink of alcohol, something happens to me where I can't stop. But I secretly suspected that everybody who drinks must surely get that thing that I get. You know, that fired up feeling of wanting more, that hunger for another one. I just thought that for some reason, a lot of people could control it, and then there were guys like me who couldn't. But Dr. Silkworth says that that's not true. He says that those non-alcoholics never experience the reaction to alcohol that I experience. That we are different, that this phenomenon of craving differentiates us and sets us apart as a distinct entity, that they will never experience that. And I couldn't conceive of that, because Silkworth also says that to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And it just made sense to me that everybody must experience that. And I didn't get it, how different I really was, until I was about four and a half years sober. And I'm dating a gal who's not an alcoholic. And we'd go out to dinner, and she'd order a drink. I swear to God, it'd take her a half hour to drink one drink. I mean, she would take a sip and then talk for 10 minutes, forget the drink's there. Do you ever forget your drink's there? I never forgot my drink. I know where my drink is. I know where your drink is. I've never forgot where my... You can watch the ice melt. I'm like, that is alcohol abuse. I remember she told me a story one time, just blew my mind. She said she was at this party, and someone had given her a marijuana cigarette from Thailand, and she took two hits off of it, and she was saving the rest for New Year's Eve. I mean, why? I mean, you might not live that long. The whole time I knew her, I never saw her drunk. She told me one time, she said she was drunk one time in college and she didn't like it. The whole time I knew her, I never even saw her finish two drinks. On occasion, she would order a second drink and she would drink half of it, two-thirds of it, a fourth of it, and she'd do the most bizarre thing you've ever seen. She'd push it aside and she'd say, I don't want any more, I'm starting to feel it. Let me tell you something, it'd be easier for me as an alcoholic to have sex and after two strokes say, I don't want any more of that, I'm starting to feel it. It would be to do that with two drinks. And I started to see how really different my reaction to alcohol was from her reaction to alcohol. See, she wasn't trying to prove a point to me. When she pushed the second drink aside, she did it because she didn't like the effect that she felt. I am enthralled with the effect. I'm obsessed with the effect. I'm so obsessed with it, I've never been able to get enough of it. And people all my life tell me I drink too much. How can you drink too much when you can't remember one instance where you ever said to yourself, you've had enough? Really? I've never had the experience that social drinkers have continually. The experience of being in a bar and drinking for an hour and have the bartender come by and say, Bob, would you like another drink? And sit there and go, no, this is just right. I've never been there. It's never been just right. But it's been almost just right. It's been on the next drink. I know it's going to be there. I've been so close, it's made me crazy. But I've never been there. And I'm an alcoholic. And I have a vacuum inside me that can never be filled. Never. We were down in the, just came from, Stan and Renee and Julie and I just came from the Cayman Islands, and we were out to dinner one night. And Renee is an Al-Anon. I get a vicarious pleasure from watching Al-Anons drink, but they don't, after watching them drink a little bit, they just make you mad. You know, they just... She orders this pina colada and sends it back because it's too strong. An alcoholic that will never happen. Never. We send it back because it's not strong enough, maybe. I'm the alcoholic that Silkworth talks about, but that's, you know, that's just a minor part of the disease. I don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to treat the phenomenon of craving. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and participate in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am an everyday member of AA. And I am that way because I come here to treat the disease of alcoholism. I come here to treat this spiritual illness that I have. If you're sitting here and you're new, in this term spiritual malady or spiritual illness makes you a little uncomfortable, I got to tell you, it did me too. I thought maybe it's a cop-out, or maybe it sort of reeked of religiosity to me. And I had it up to here with religion by the time I got to AA. But there's a line in We Agnostics, and it says, do not let these terms deter you from asking yourself, what do they mean to you? And I got to tell you what was real true for me. When I stopped drinking and I was sober, it seemed like my spirit, my life force, seemed to withdraw, almost feel sickly and shriveled and depressed. 5 shots of Jack Daniels vitalized my spirit. I think, and I believe this with every fiber in my being, that alcohol for a number of years, before the scales tipped, before in the beginning several years of my drinking, alcohol was the most immediate and effective treatment for the inside dis-ease of alcoholism I've ever found. It was a phenomenal thing, phenomenal. I remember, I can tell you a dozen experiences. I'll share one of them. We all have our own. When I was in ninth grade, some kid in our neighborhood's parents went out of town. He had this big house, pretty wealthy family. And he threw this big party, invited everybody from the school. And I'm going because everybody's going there. And I remember walking up the front of this walk up to the front door, and I'm uncomfortable. You can hear the music and stuff in the house. And I walked in the front door, and I'm standing inside the front door, and over in this one room is a bunch of couples sitting on sofas, and they're making out. In this other room, there's a whole bunch of people dancing, and you can hear the music rolling through the house. Back in the kitchen, this big kitchen, there's a whole bunch of guys around this keg of beer, and the laughter's rolling through the house. And you could tell all these people were just having a great time. And I remember standing inside that front of that house looking at all that with a feeling like it's all of them and then there's me. And I felt that feelings of separation. I felt that loneliness. I wanted to turn around and bolt and run out of there. But I was so afraid of what people would think if I don't show up there and I'm going to miss something and all that kind of stuff that I stayed. And I slunk around that house for a few minutes and people would say hi to me. I could barely even answer them. I'd just say hi. And I couldn't mix with people. I couldn't talk to them very well. And I found this card table with a bottle of 151 rum, some Coca-Cola, some big cups. After about 2 of those, man, I'm dancing. I've got a girlfriend. Later on, I'm back in the kitchen. I am lifelong friends with the guys on the football team. I mean, I am connected. Alcohol, at that moment in my life, relieved me of the bondage of self. It brought me out here where I could play. It connected me to life. It gave me a sense of completeness that I had never had. Alcohol was a dynamic treatment for the disease of alcoholism. Because I got to tell you, when I stood inside that front door in that house, I was sick of spirit. And we all know, there's a line in our book that says that we know a loneliness such as few do. And alcoholics, because we are so introspective, self-involved people, I went through my life knowing a loneliness that was just sometimes heartbreaking because it was a funny kind of loneliness. It was the kind of loneliness where I could be surrounded by people who cared about me and loved me, and I still, and it seemed like there was some kind of invisible, impenetrable barrier between me and them. I could not connect with them the way I could observe them connecting with each other. And five shots of whiskey, and I could come out and play. Five shots of whiskey, I could talk to anybody about anything. Five shots of whiskey, and I was free. And then I would sober up, and I'm back to a victim of the bondage of self again, locked up inside of me. And it's because of that aspect of my alcoholism that I almost died of alcoholism. It is what happens to me when I stop drinking that is really the deadly force in my life. That's why I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to stop drinking. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous to treat what happens to me once I've stopped drinking so I can remain comfortably in a state of abstinence. In 1971, I went to my first AA meeting, and I sat there, and I remember being, I was a perpetual newcomer for a long time. I hated being a newcomer in AA. First of all, by the time I get back into AA again, it's like I'm not in good shape. You know what I mean? I don't come in here in good shape. It's like it's not the high point of my life. And back in Pennsylvania, back in the 70s, they'd always want you to stand up and be recognized. I don't want to stand up and have people look at me. It is not, I don't have anything I want recognized in my life. I feel like a failure. You know, and it always felt like to me, now I understand this was not going on, but it almost felt like they were saying, let's have that guy Bob, that loser Bob, stand up so we can all look at him and feel better about ourselves. You know? It always kind of felt like that to me. And you guys were so, and you were so enthusiastic. And I don't, you take alcohol out of my life. I don't want to be around a lot of happy, enthusiastic people. I really don't. I just, you make me crazy. I don't know what you're about. You're like a weird cross between the Salvation Army and Amway. I mean, you're just a weird bunch of people. And you're always glad to see me. And, oh, and you, I remember being in this halfway house, right? I'm sitting in there because if it's an alternative to 2 years in prison, I'm homeless. I have nobody left. I am so overwhelmed with shame and guilt. I am sick. I've still got unhealed sores from, because I used to get those don't eat wine sores. I'm a mess. And I'm sitting in there, and people from AA would come in there to bring meetings, and I'd have to listen to an endless procession of people telling me how wonderful their life is. And it's like, what, have I died and gone to hell? Everything that you were just seemed to point out in stark relief everything I wasn't. And I came to a conclusion, and I work with a lot of guys, and I came to a conclusion that a lot of people come to when they come in here. And the conclusion seemed self-evident to me, and yet it was an erroneous conclusion. And the conclusion was that looking at how I feel when I stop drinking, and looking and listening to how you look and feel and sound when you stop drinking, whatever's wrong with me is not the same thing that is wrong with you, because I stopped drinking and I don't feel like you sound or look. I stopped drinking and I'm not, it seemed like everybody in AA was grateful for everything. I'm not grateful for anything. Not only am I not grateful, I don't even like anything. Everybody in AA loved everybody. I don't even like anybody. There's a few people I'd like to know where they lived and when they wouldn't be home. But I don't like anybody. I'm the guy Silkworth talks about. I stop drinking, I become restless, irritable, and discontent. But what's that mean? If you're sitting here, you knew, well, that sounds like words. Restless means wherever I am, I can't settle in. It ain't right. wherever I am, it's not the right thing. Did you ever watch a dog look for its spot? How it just goes around and around? I'm a dog who can't find its spot. I'm restless. I'm irritable. And what happens, you take alcohol out of my life, and life just rubs me the wrong way. And people rub me the wrong way. They won't do things right. Did you ever notice that? They're always getting out of line. And what happens to me is because life and people irritate me, I either do one of two things. I either get cocky and on the muscle around people and kind of aggressive, and I'm kind of one of those get away from me kind of guys, you know, that always with a big mouth. Or else I get so withdrawn that some psychiatrist is diagnosing me as clinically depressed. And then I get restless, irritable, and discontent. And the discontent touches down to the core of my disease. I heard alcoholism many years ago described as a disease of chronic malcontent. There's something about me that is I never get the sense of wholeness and completeness that it seems like everybody else gets. It's always that there's something missing. And I'm not talking about drinking. I'm talking about sober. That there's always a vague, vague sense that there's something missing. And people like me, who have this spiritual malady and this chronic malcontent, we develop cases of the when eyes. Are you happy, Bob? No, but when I get that promotion, when I make the kind of money that that guy makes, or when I'm married and have a relationship like he has, or when I retire, or when my kids are grown, or when I. But right now, and I only ever live right now, I'm still chronically malcontent. It's like there's a piece missing. I think sometimes to have alcoholism is like being doomed to walk through life with a stone in your shoe. But it's a small, tiny little stone. A mild irritant that just kind of gnaws at you. And if you're like me, you take your shoe off and you shake it out, you put it back on, you're walking, and there it is again. And it just kind of bugs you. It's just something ain't right. And if you're like me, you go to foot doctors and foot clinics and get your foot anesthetized maybe, and then the anesthetic wears off, and there it is again. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978, and for probably my first 15 years here, I was a victim of a delusion that it talks about in chapter 3. It says the delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. I came here thinking that there was going to be something eventually in AA, maybe like at 10 years or 15 years sober, where I would finally have the ultimate surrender, you know, not like the other 200, you know, the ultimate surrender. Or I would finally do the fourth step that uncovered the thing that we all spend our lives looking for, you know, when we weren't potty trained properly or whatever that thing is, you know. And what would happen is that the stone would be gone once and for all from my shoe to never return. And it took me 15 years in Alcoholics Anonymous to realize that that's not going to happen. But Alcoholics Anonymous is not even about that. But what Alcoholics Anonymous is about for a guy like me, it's not about getting the stone out of my shoe once and for all. It's about hanging out with a whole bunch of people that all have stones in their shoes, and I get so caught up listening to them whine about their stone that for long periods of time I forget I got one in mine. But I got to tell you, if I get my attention off of you and trying to help others and thinking about others and get it back on me too long, what happens is the stone comes back, and it comes back right away. I'll tell you an experience I had. I'm bouncing around. That's just the way I am. When I was about a couple years sober, I was going to this late night meeting in Las Vegas, and I had had a really good day. I had one of those kind of days when I'm just kind of going with the flow. I was working as a cashier in a store. The customers were okay that day. The boss was okay. Everything's fine. I have no problems. No, there's no wolf barking at my door. No crises. I go to this late night meeting. I'm walking in the meeting. It's about ready to start. This guy, Wade, comes up to me. He looks me in the eye and he says, "Bob, how are you doing? How are you really doing?" And the meeting started and I sat there and I thought, oh, what's he know? I thought I was doing good. I must be in that denial thing that they talk about. And I sat there and I looked around the room and it just become, all of a sudden I started feeling my feelings and getting into them and I started looking at everybody and just, I could see, God, everybody's happier than I am. And I said, and I started feeling, I don't even feel good physically anymore. You know, and that job that I thought was so good, you know, I could see now that they're taking advantage of me. And I'm probably never going to get laid. Everybody has part, everybody's doing great. And I just sank into this abyss. This abyss, right? And what had changed? Nothing. Nothing had changed. This. I started to get into this. And when I started to get into this, my life started to turn to crap. And maybe that's one of the reasons in alcohol, they spend so much time in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous on working with others. And they make statements in there like nothing ensures immunity from drinking, like intensive work with other alcoholics. There's a statement in there that says, my very life as an ex-problem drinker depends upon my constant thought of others, their needs, and how I can work for them. Constant. Who did they write that for? Al-Anons? Constant thought. I can't do constant. I can do periodic. I can do occasional, but constant, I can't do it. But I do enough that I have islands in my life where I've my self-obsession has been interrupted. And my self-centeredness, my self-involvement has been interrupted. I just, you know, I was telling John, I've had a great 10 days or so. We were down in the Cayman Islands for a week and just we had a wonderful time. I've had a great time here this weekend. But I'll tell you something, I've had about as much self-indulgence as I can stand. Can't wait to get back to the guys I sponsor, my Skid Row detox meetings that I have commitments twice a week at, the halfway houses that I go to. That is my, I live an abundant, opulent lifestyle, but I stay in the trenches of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stay in them every single day. Because that's where I get free. That's where I get the same effect that I found in 4 or 5 shots of Jose Cuervo when I was 17 or 18 years old. That's where I get free from the bondage of self. And I'll tell you another phenomenon that I've discovered here, and this does not make any sense at all. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous after 28 years of being driven to try to make me better. Driven to try to make my life better, richer, more abundant, trying to make me better. And the end result is I come in here and I'm homeless and I have nothing. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous so beaten and demoralized that I gave up. I make Alcoholics Anonymous the center of my life. I start getting into the steps in AA. I take a third step and I make a commitment of self-abandonment. And I'm going to try to make my life none of my business. I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self and to do all that so that victory over that would bear witness to those that I would help. I'm making a commitment to self-abandonment and service to others. And what happens is that a lifestyle that I always would have dreamed of just seems to come to me as a result of leaving my life alone. Now that is absolutely insane. But that has been my experience the last over 21 years. I don't spend a lot of time trying to make me better. I spend a lot of time trying to help others. And as a result of doing that, I get better and my life gets better. And that doesn't, if you're new here, that sounds like putting your life under the pillow waiting for the tooth fairy. I mean, it makes about as much sense. If there was an argument, if there was a debate to go on of whether AA worked or it didn't work, it would be a better side to be on the debate that it didn't work, except that we are here. And we have been, our lives have been transformed. In 1977, I was in a Skid Row halfway house in Pittsburgh, and I was staying sober. I was one of those kind of guys that I couldn't stay sober. I wanted to, and I would make the commitments to myself. I'm never going to drink again. And what would happen to me is that as the further I got away from the last drink, the more empty and the more restless, irritable, and discontent I would become. Abstinence would start to feel like I was doing time. And what happens to me is that I just get it up to here, and I get a feeling that comes over me that I just got to bust out of this abstinence thing. Like I'm doomed to a life where I'm stupid, boring, and glum. And I went on a drunk with a guy that was in the halfway house. I talked him into going on the drunk with me, and I did because he had a little trailer, and I was homeless. I had no place to stay. So we went on this drunk, and I'm able to crash on the couch in his trailer, and we come back one night after been drinking a long time. We come into this trailer, and he goes back in the bedroom and passes out. Well, I'm the kind of alcoholic that if I'm still awake, I ain't done drinking. You know, I'm just the kind of drunk I am. I've just never sat down and said, well, this is enough. I'm awake, I ain't done drinking. And he left his car keys and his wallet on the kitchen counter. Now, I'm not a thief, but I do know when a loan's appropriate. And I took his car keys and I took some money and I went out to go get some beer or something to drink. And the next thing I know, I'm coming to in a jail cell. I've been arrested for a felony DUI, hit and run, and a stolen car. I'm sitting in there, I'm trying to get my phone call, and I'm trying to call these bail bondsmen to get me out of here. I have no more friends left, I have nobody left. The only guy I knew, I'd wrecked his car. He don't even want to talk to me, he won't even answer my phone calls. I'm calling these bail bonds. Bail bondsmen are weird. They want you to have like an address and a job and stuff like that. So I can't make bail, so I'm stuck in there for several months. I go before a judge. This judge reads all this stuff off to me, and he knows about all my arrests, and I guess from the probation and parole department, he knows about the treatment centers and everything and he reads all this stuff off to me, and then he sentences me to 2 years in the state penitentiary. And I got to tell you, when he said that, I felt like my life was over. Because I'm standing there and I'm sober, I'm dry, and I'm being sentenced to 2 years in the state penitentiary, and I'm horrified. See, I don't jail well. Some people jail well. I don't jail well. I don't like it. I don't like going in there and putting on that gorilla outfit and having to act tough and when you're a scared little kid inside. I never liked that. And he did that, I felt like my life was over. I thought, I'll kill myself. I can't do 2 years. And he did something that was very unusual. He said, we're going to stay the commitment. We're not going to carry it out. The PO department has found this place called the Ark House. It's on the north side of Pittsburgh. He said, it's the only place that they could find, they'll take you, because I'd burn out every other place. He said, if you'll go in there, and you'll stay in there for a year, and you get good UAs, good PO reports, make the restitution, do everything you're supposed to do, you come back before me on a certain date, and we'll take a look at this. If you don't, you're done. So I went into this place, and winter's coming on, and I have no place to go, and I don't want to do the time in jail. So I went in there determined to stay sober. And I got to tell you that if determination was enough, I'd have been sober from that moment to this. But I'm the alcoholic that it talks about in the big book when it says, lack of power is my dilemma. But it doesn't matter how much I've made up my mind, I'm never going to drink again. I'm the type of alcoholic that eventually has to drink. Unless I have a transformation, unless I have a spiritual awakening, I will drink again. And I go into this place and I'm hanging on and I'm not drinking week in and week out and month in and month out, and I'm just getting up to here. And my life seems so boring and lonely and empty, I can't stand it. And I'm going to these AA meetings and listening to all these happy people, and I'm just miserable. And I'm getting ready to drink, and I know it. And after an in-house meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did something I'd never done before. I grabbed a guy in AA that I didn't even know, and I said, I need to talk to somebody. And he sat down there in this dining hall with me, and he listened to me go on for a long time about my problems. And I told him about the 2 years I was facing, and I told him about my failures at trying to stay sober, and how I'd tried and was determined I kept drinking again. I told him about the shame and the guilt that just seemed to flood over me, sometimes in waves, because of the things I did to my mom and my dad, and they all they ever did was love me, and I just tore their hearts out. Of the things I did to some really, really nice people. I told him about my emotional problems, and I'd been to a lot of therapy, and it didn't seem to do anything for me. But I was one of those kind of guys, I could be sitting in the TV room, just doing good. And then all of a sudden, I just sink into this depression and nobody's even done nothing to me, you know? It's just wacko, these mood swings. And I have crazy thoughts running through my head all the time, just nuts stuff. I mean, my head was just chattering at me all the time, and none of it's good stuff, you know? I'd walk into a room and somebody kind of looks at me and looks away, and I know they hate me, you know? And I want to kill them. And if somebody doesn't say hi to me, I build a case against them. Just nuts stuff. I get a headache. I could feel brain tumors growing in my head. You know, it's just wacko stuff. And I can't sleep right at night because my head won't leave me alone. Living with my head in early sobriety is like driving cross country in a van full of 8-year-olds that have overdosed on sugar and none of them like you. It's just all this... What is it, Bob? What is it? What do you think, Bob? You can't stay sober, Bob. Who do you just... I can't work. I can get a job. I can get good jobs. I can't hold them. I'm the guy that they call into the office all the time and say, Bob, we're going to let you go. There's something wrong with your attitude. What does that mean? Nobody ever tells me what that means. What do you mean, attitude? Or the one that used to make me crazy, they'd say, you're a hard worker, Bob. We're going to have to let you go because you're not a team player. Yeah. Right. I'm not a sober. I don't fit very well. I'm not a team player. Give me a pint of Jack Daniels. I'll lead your damn team. Sober. I can't mix with those people right. I can't laugh and carry on and have a good time and be one of the guys sober. I don't know how to do it. I just don't. I ain't wired that way. I stop drinking and I just get too self-absorbed. And when you're in your head here, no wonder I go through life and I don't feel like I fit in the world. Because you know something? I ain't in the world. I'm in this one. And when you're way back in here, no wonder life looks so far away and distant. And I can't fit. And I'm telling this guy all this stuff about the shame and the guilt and the jobs and the prison and all this stuff. And I said, I need help. He reaches in his pocket. He pulls out his business card with his phone number and he gives it to me. He points up to the wall, and there's a thing on there with the 12 steps. He said, if you'll put those steps in your life, and he says, I'll help you. All this stuff's going to change. And he gets up and he walks way to the back of the kitchen to get a cup of coffee. And I'm sitting there and I'm looking at these 12 steps, and I had seen them in the rooms, but I'm reading them. You know, and I start reading these steps, and it becomes real apparent to me that this guy has not heard anything I just told him. There's nothing in those steps, nothing, that relates to any problem I just told him. There's not, I mean, stretch your imagination all you want. There's no connection here. I mean, I need a set of steps like step one, make Bob's police record disappear. Step two, give him $1,000. Step three, bring her back properly ashamed of herself. Step four, make my family realize how wrong they've been about me. I was always obsessed with thinking someday my family will figure out how wrong they were about me, and she'll figure out, they'll figure out. I remember fantasies about. I read one time in this hospital waiting room, in this emergency room waiting room, this pamphlet about cancer, and it said that, well, 7 warning signs, and one of them was bleeding. I was bleeding out both ends, so I just thought I have a brain tumor. It explained a lot. I mean, you know, and I figured, you know, one day they're going to find me in the park, and they're going to put me in the cancer ward, and they're going to notify my family that I'm dying of a brain tumor, and they're going to rush to the hospital realizing how wrong they'd been, you know. And if they're properly contrite, I may forgive them. I don't know. You know, I find out later I got a bleeding ulcer and hemorrhoids, you know. And I was disappointed. I'm always thinking, what's wrong with me, you know? I tell you, one time in this county jail, I was reading this novel, and there's this account, this novel, this character, and he's got syphilis. And it's at real advanced stages in the book, and it went to his brain, and it made him crazy. And he would have periods where he'd do stuff and couldn't remember it. Then he'd have other periods where he'd become so depressed and withdrawn, and then other periods we'd fly off the handle. I remember reading that thinking, that's it. I got syphilis. It went to my brain. I ended up in a detox, well, like 5 or 6 months later, and this doctor's interviewing me about, I'd been in there before, and he says, well, you're back for alcoholism. And I said, no, doc, you see, you were wrong. I don't have alcoholism. I got syphilis, and it went to my brain. He looks at me and says, well, you might have that too, but we're pretty sure you have alcoholism. So I look at the stats, and they don't do anything. They're not going to help me. See, they just don't apply to my problems. You got steps like turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Well, that you guys could do that. You're nice people. See, I grew up, I know what God is. I grew up, I went to Catholic school, I learned about God. First of all, God exists to judge me. And he can see in the dark, and that's not good for a guy like me. That's a bad, bad deal. He can read my mind. I'm always thinking stuff. I shouldn't. I remember the nuns used to say, you got to be pure of thought, word, and deed. And then I'd catch myself imagining what they look like under their habits. You know, I, oh, no. Oh, I'm going to burn for that one. That's. And I'm always thinking stuff that I'm not supposed to be thinking. I can't stop it. I can't help myself. And it's some. And I'm always in trouble. I'm always the guy that they're sending this to the priest or the principal. This priest one time, he says, he's giving me a lecture, and I said, oh, Father, I'm probably going to go to hell. He says, no, son. He says, God's created a place to show his mercy for people like you. It's called purgatory. It's like hell. They burn you and torture you, but it only lasts for a couple hundred million years, maybe. So I get to be 12 years old. I don't want to offend anybody, but I discover masturbation. I can picture this meter in heaven clicking off for millions of years. And I haven't even done anything yet. I'm just practicing. So I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I see, turn your will and your life over to the care of God. I'd rather turn it over to a narcotics agent than I went to a God. Not God. Let me turn it over to Charles Manson. I'd have a better shot. And the amends step. Oh, geez, not that. You guys can do that. I mean, I could look around AA and see that the amends step was good for you. I'm sure some of you got too drunk and said something unkind to your wife. You should go apologize. You padded your expense account. Take care of it. I lived on the streets like an animal. I mean, I robbed guys. There's a guy walking around. I've never been able to make amends to him. I stuck a knife through his chest, almost killed him. I was that kind of guy. I was the kind of guy, if you felt sorry for me, you let me sleep on your couch when you went to work. I robbed you. I mean, it wasn't personal. I just did that stuff, you know? And I can't picture making amends. I imagine going up to the head of an outlaw motorcycle gang that went to prison as a result of my actions and saying, well, Cheech, I'm a sober member of AA. I want you to forgive me for the 5 years I caught. You know, I might as well put a gun to my head. So the guy comes back to the table. I'm looking at these steps, and I know what, this isn't it. So I just get up and I walk, shuffle off to my room, and I started my last drunk a couple days after that. You see, I go on a run, and alcohol will take everything away from me. I end up back in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first thing I get back is my opinion. And it's my opinion and my judgment that kept me from getting everything that God would ever give His most beloved kids. And I think those of us who have alcoholism have been given the greatest blessing God gives His kids. I heard a Catholic priest define a blessing one time as, a blessing was anything that pushed you, shoved you, or dragged you screaming into being more than what you are. If that's true, alcoholism, believe me, is the greatest blessing God could ever give a guy like me. The greatest blessing. Even though it almost killed me. And this guy walked away, and I went to my last drunk, and I tried to commit suicide, and I tried to commit suicide because I felt utterly hopeless. I can't stay sober. Abstinence is a desolate, lonely, unbearable place for me. And drunkenness no longer fun anymore. It's a sick, rummy, awful place also. And when you can't live with it and you can't live without it, suicide starts looking like a good alternative. And I stood on a bridge looking in Pittsburgh, looking down on these railroad tracks 100 feet below, sobbing uncontrollably because I just couldn't get up enough courage to overcome the fear of dying or mutilating myself to jump. And I tell you something, it seemed like the right thing to do at that point. And you know what would have been tragic beyond belief? If I would have been able to get the courage to jump, I would have jumped believing that I had tried Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have jumped thinking that I had been a part of AA. And I got to tell you something, at that point in my life, I went to hundreds of meetings, but I was never a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was part of the passing parade that goes through Alcoholics Anonymous on its way to the graveyard. And in 1978, coming off my last drunk, in a detox hospital in Las Vegas, I had a surrender. And I got out of a group that exists. I think there's an invisible line through every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on the face of the earth. And in one side of that line is the people that are dying of alcoholism, and the other side of the line is the people that are recovering. And I got to tell you, I know what it feels like to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and die of untreated alcoholism. Been there. And I was on the one side of the line in 1978. I got out of that group and got into the other group. And it talks about it in the beginning of chapter 5. It says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. And I was one of those guys. I couldn't completely do this. I'd do little bits here and there, but I couldn't buy the whole package because it didn't make sense to me. It was inconvenient. It was uncomfortable. I was still running my life on how I felt and what I thought. In 1978, I gave myself simply to this, very completely to this simple program. I made it the center of my life, and my life started to change. I joined a home group and I got a sponsor and got real involved in AA. I'm still real involved. I started doing hospital institution commitments. I still do a minimum of 2 a week when I'm in town. I work with a lot of newcomers. I'm involved in big book workshops and step studies. I try to keep my nose in that book on a regular basis because that's where my solution is. I've joined a group who believed in the process in that book. And I'm really glad that I did. You know, for a lot of years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I took a lot of actions that at many times seemed like they were unnecessary. Because if you're like me, after you're sober for a while, what happens is your life gets good. If you're doing AA, and you're working with newcomers, and you're cleaning house, and you're trusting God, and you're involved in this fellowship, things get good. And I'm the type of guy, when things get good, I start wondering why I'm doing all this work. And I think sometimes it's like forging a weapon. and you never know when you're going to need it. In my 11th year of sobriety, I realized all of a sudden why I did everything I'd ever done the first 11, almost 10 and a half years. My 11th year of sobriety, I was married to a gal I'd met in AA. We'd been married for 4.5 years. We had a daughter that was a year and a half old. And my wife came to me one day and out of nowhere, and said she wanted a divorce. And it seemed to me out of nowhere because my self-centeredness takes a form sometimes where I get so wrapped up in me and my life that I'm not paying attention to you. And unless you wave a red flag in front of me, if I just assume everything's okay, I'm too self-involved. And she waved the flag. She says, I want a divorce. And we started going through the... I don't want to do this. Will we go to some marriage counseling? And she said, yeah. She says, all right, I'll go to some marriage counseling. We started going to some marriage counseling. My sponsor had retired, and he bought this big RV, and he was on the East Coast on a 6-month sabbatical, driving all over the place, and he's gone. So the guy that I'm using for my confidant is a guy named Craig, who I sponsor, who's sober a couple of years. He's become my best friend. So I'm sharing with him, since my sponsor's gone, all my marriage problems. After going to the marriage counseling for a while, my wife comes to me one day. She says, I don't want to go to counseling anymore. I just want out. In Las Vegas, you can get divorced quick if you don't contest it. I mean, you'd spin your head so quick. We were divorced on a Thursday. The next day, Friday, my wife and daughter move in with Craig, my best friend. And I find out all of a sudden that they've been sleeping together for the last year of my marriage. And everybody in AA seems like they know it except me. What John was alluding to earlier, John and I, during this process, are doing, at the Las Vegas Roundup, we're asked to do a workshop on relationships. And I got to tell you, John, I gave a heck of a talk. Well, don't you think so? I mean, that was just wonderful. And my wife and my best friend are sitting in the front row, smiling up at me. And I'm giving this great talk about how wonderful our marriage is, and I don't even know that they're sleeping each other. I mean, that is an ironic picture that is etched in my brain, that I think God has a bizarre sense of humor. Anything that in Alcoholics Anonymous I ever thought I was, be ready, I may not be that. Everything I've ever thought I'm not, look out, I may be. So here I am, I'm in my 11th year of sobriety. You guys have been telling me for 11 years there's no such thing as a justifiable resentment. Well, I got one now. And I can even find people in the meetings that'll agree with me. I'm intuitive like that. You know, I can walk into 100 people and just kind of be drawn to the people that'll just agree and co-sign my crap. You know, I don't know what it is about me, just like a magnetism of some sort. And the problem with that is that I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And you can get a little bit of ego justification out of being a victim for a short period of time, but if you have the spiritual malady of alcoholism that I have, you cannot stand the separation for long periods of time. I cannot stand to be locked up inside me, stewing in my own juices for a long period of time. It will devour me. And I'll tell you, my God was very, very merciful to me. He sent me swarms of newcomers that are all going through relationship, marriage breakups. And I would pile them in my car, and we'd go to meetings together. We'd be like the depressed section of the meeting, you know. You could hear the secretaries tell the chairman, oh, don't call on them, you know. I mean, there's nobody more self-obsessed on the face of the earth than an alcoholic going through a relationship breakup. You can go up to somebody like that and say, I just came from the doctor, I got terminal cancer, I got 3 weeks to live, and he'll say, and you know what else she said, man? I mean, but these guys that God threw at me gave me islands in my day where I wasn't so self-involved in my own pain and my own crap. Until I was able to come back and do the fourth step again as it's outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a, I want to talk a little bit about this one part. In the resentment section, there's a part that's very overlooked. And I've come to believe it is the most important part of the whole four-step process. It is really the part that enables me to get the 180-degree turn in consciousness. It is really the part that enables me to come out the other side of the fourth step different from when I was on prior to it. And it says in there very simply, it says, this was our course. We must realize how the people who had harmed us were perhaps like us, spiritually sick, even though we didn't like their symptoms and how they affected us, that they, like us, were sick too. And the book is asking me to realize something I don't want to realize. It's asking me to put myself in their position and to look at the marriage and the divorce and everything through their eyes. Self-absorbed, self-obsessed people like me don't want to do that. I want to, because I got my own agenda and my own judgment. And so I got to look at the marriage through their eyes. And when I looked at it through my wife's eyes, you know what I saw? Broke my heart. I saw a gal that was raised in an alcoholic home. She grew up in such a way that she was unable up until this point in her life to face confrontation. And all of a sudden she gets married to a guy who thinks he's Mr. AA, who's trying to build a business. He's working 70 hours a week. He's got all these AA commitments, all these people he's sponsoring. He's doing all this stuff in AA. She puts her whole life into this marriage, and all of a sudden she's married to a guy who really just isn't there very much. Now, I could tell you some half-truths here. One of the half-truths was, well, I had to work a lot. It was my one chance to build that business. And that is true. I could also tell you, and I had to do the AA stuff to keep sane while doing that. And that's also true. But there's a deeper truth, and the deeper truth is that all that stuff was convenient because I don't know how to do intimacy very well. After about 6 months or a year in a relationship, I've told you every funny story I got. I've shared with you everything I know how to share with you. And now it's just, now what? So I get busy. I don't know what else to do because I hadn't learned how to be intimate yet. And I started to see what she must have experienced, and I started to sense the loneliness and the desolation she must have felt in that marriage. And when I was able to really look at it through her eyes, you know what I saw? I thought to myself, I saw a bad situation. I saw me as self-centered and as wrapped up in my life as I really was. The book says, sometimes people hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we will invariably find that at some time in the past, we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in that position to be hurt. And I was the guy who did it. I made certain decisions based on my own self-centered fears about my life, and I never once stopped to say, Karen, is this okay with you? John and I were just talking about this the other day, just how we make these huge plans for vacations and then go, oh, by the way, we're doing this. That's the way I was. Not because I'm a bad guy. That's what self-centered people do. And I started to see what was going on in her through her eyes, and I realized to myself, my God, I don't know how she went as long as she did. If it would have been me, I probably would have had an affair a year before she did. And I probably wouldn't have liked myself very much for doing it, but I would have probably done it. And I started to get a sense of her pain and what she had felt as a result of those actions. And I did the same thing with him, and I started to be able to repair a relationship with them. And I tell you, Karen's one of my closer friends today. We do a lot of, we talk all the time. I sponsor Craig again. I've been sponsoring him for a while. Matter of fact, Julie and I are getting married on the beach in Maui, April 3rd, and I'm thinking about asking him to be the best man. I told him, but he's got to keep his distance. And that's where the healing came from. It came from that fourth step. And if you're sitting here and you're new, or maybe you're not so new, I get to sponsor a lot of guys that come to me that are 15, 20, over 20 years sober that are absolutely insane because they're 20 years sober and they've never worked the steps. If you've never worked the steps and you're thinking about doing the steps, we have a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that there's 1,000 treatment centers that put out pamphlets on how to work the steps. If you want what we have, do what we do. And I've become a fundamentalist in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've become a fundamentalist because I'll tell you what frightens me sometimes. Every generation that comes into AA, especially out of treatment centers, brings in this new information. And they make little twists to the fellowship and to the program. And they all seem like well-intentioned, kind of nice things, and maybe they won't hurt. But if every generation does a couple things like that, the Alcoholics Anonymous that we will have in 100 years will not be the same Alcoholics Anonymous we had 50, 60 years ago. And I've become a fundamentalist in Alcoholics Anonymous because I have kids, and I want my kids, if they develop alcoholism, I want them to have the same program of recovery that saved my life. Because I've tried the religion, and I've tried the therapy, and I tried all that, and it wasn't until I came here and completely gave myself to this simple program was I able to find a way to live comfortably with the disease of alcoholism. If you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm real glad you're here. I hope from the bottom of my heart that you can connect with something here that I've connected with. If you can connect with the process and a fellowship, you'll eventually connect with a power source here that will transform your life. We have good news and we have bad news in Alcoholics Anonymous. The good news, what we have here really is an effective treatment for the inside emptiness of alcoholism. The bad news, it doesn't work as fast as 5 shots of tequila. Thank you.